underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. The Irish writer Colm Tobin has written 8 novels, 2 books of short stories, and multiple works of nonfiction. His last novel, Nora Webster, follows a widow in 1970s Ireland as she moves through her mourning toward a new life. That book was almost 15 years in the making, and to Bean's previous novel, Brooklyn, which centers on an Irish immigrant to the United States, grew out of Nora Webster's early pages. His other books include The Blackwater Lightship, The Testament of Mary, and The Master, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Colm Tobin to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. When you think of your work, and I just said in the introduction, the 15 years in the making, does that seem right to you to have that time to work through something?
I think it was a particular book which dealt with things that had happened, which is often more difficult than things imagined, because you're trying to put shape on them. And it was really the story of what happened in our house in Enniscorthy, in the southeast of Ireland, from 1967, for the next 3 or 4 years after my father died. I'm 12, my younger brother is 8, and my mother is, I think, 46, 47. And it was something that was always with me, you know, as memory. And then it started to come with me as story. And then I started to try and put shape on it, and that's really what took the time. It wasn't as though I worked every day on it. What would happen would be I would write a chapter and think, I just don't know where we'll go from here, because so much that I could put in, but that would be all details that mightn't interest anybody. I have to find something that is true to the story, true to what happened, but it's also interesting, also brings the story forward emotionally for the reader, almost like an arc. But there's not much of an arc here, because it's really just imperceptible change in the way someone's living, having had loss, where it isn't as though she wins the lottery or goes to America or goes mad or anything, you know, strange and big happens. It's slow, but it's real, the change and the growth and the difference. So I have to register that in a way that's true, but also in a way that might be interesting.
As I mentioned in the introduction, Nora Webster grew out of Brooklyn. Was there a point where you realized you could go there, either you weren't ready or you didn't want to?
Yeah, it was almost a relief when I went back and read the first few pages. I was just going to read the first chapter of Nora Webster again, just to see how I'd started with it, basically so I could write another chapter. And I found about page 3, a woman coming to the house, which happened a lot in our house, where in those months after my father died, people would just come to the house and they would just talk. At the beginning and end, they would mention my father, but in the middle, they would just talk. And often it was very interesting, especially interesting when somebody left and they might talk about them or say something interesting that I had never heard before. I suppose I was a little novelist. I didn't know I was, but I was listening. And so I found on about page 3 of Nora Webster, basically the entire story of Brooklyn. And I remember the night, I was on my own and I was in a house in Wexford in the southeast of Ireland, and I just saw it and said, there it is. But I thought it was a short story. I thought it was a short book. It was only when I started to work on it that the details became very real for me. I suppose I had, for the first time, been living in the United States. I had been teaching for a semester in Texas, which is very far from the sea and seems very far from Ireland in the way everything worked. You know, and so I had come home, and I've been thinking then, maybe not much but enough, about all those Irish people who had gone, you know, over 150 years, and realized this is where I'm staying, you know, wherever they landed in America, wherever they ended in America. Home now is going to be this strange, ambiguous thing. Home is a dream of Ireland, and home is the real day here, wherever I am, in Connecticut or in upstate New York. So the novel came to me in rich detail. I mean, I could see what her first months were like in Brooklyn. And the idea, you know, things that you just don't think about. How cold New York is compared to Ireland, even though Ireland has a long winter. It doesn't have that biting bone cold. And also the noises in the house where you're staying, just the way the heating comes on, the whole way people respond to you, the whole business of homesickness lasting for a certain time, being very intense, and then fading. And then you slowly get used to the new place until you have either two homes or no home, and you're not sure which.
Even in just talking about it, as I think is reflected in the novel, it seems to me a great nostalgia.
I'm not sure about nostalgia for, say, a period. I mean, you see, I didn't want to... You see, it couldn't be set in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I'd have to introduce the miniskirt, the twist, and all Chubby Checker to Elvis Presley to all the music. And it would just be a novel about the 60s. Once you put the 60s into a novel, the 60s has a way of taking over. And I didn't want it during the war... So I want that period, 1951, 52, 53, seemed to me, even though there were things going on politically, but that really a period where there was no big change going on in the social life of America that I would have to start writing big, long pages about. I mean, fashions were remaining pretty stable, knee length. You know, the stores, I know that it was the beginning of nylon. After the war, nylon being mass produced. So she's working in a store that really is selling cheap nylon. And that's a very big deal in those years. I knew enough about that because my mother had two younger sisters. And so they talked a lot about style and clothes. And they would have been born around the same time as Eilish Lacey, who's the protagonist of Brooklyn. So I sort of knew enough about that.
And I guess when I say nostalgic, I mean for those experiences that you mentioned a moment ago, of that idea of coming to this country and being in that home and hearing those sounds and that idea of a dream and whether it works or not.
You see, I thought when I was writing it that it was an Irish book, and because this really has been the secret history of Ireland for 150 years and for more now, of every generation, families losing people. And that loss and the imagination, you know, you're imagining, what are they doing now? And it doesn't really matter with Skype or texting or cheaper flights. I mean, the people are generally away and you lose them. You just don't have them all the time. But then when the book came out and I was here, I realized, of course, for America, this is also an American story, but it is a happier story in a way. It's that everybody comes from, you know, everybody, say, who's not a Native American and who also didn't come with slavery, but everyone who came as an immigrant, everybody comes from somebody who came alone with a suitcase. And that's the big thing in the back of everyone's mind. Somewhere before me, someone came alone with a suitcase. And I wonder what that was like for them. Because it was both hopeful and difficult. And so Americans began to read the book in a different way than I had written it.
Did that show itself, do you think, even more so in the film?
No, because when the film was shown in Enniscorthy, where I'm from, it was filmed there. You know, it was an odd idea that I had experienced the town. That's where I'm from. I had then imagined the town for the novel, put it into the book. Then the camera came and the lighting men and the whole rigs came and they lit the town, captured the town for film. And then on the 28th of October, with two screenings, we showed the film twice in Enniscorthy to the people of Enniscorthy. And that was a great night in the town, and people recognized themselves, and people recognized that's like my aunt. That's my street. That's the way my mother had a cardigan exactly like that. So it was a, you know, it was a, I suppose it had to be accurate about that before it was accurate about anything else. If it gets the Irish part wrong, then really the rest is wrong too.
I won't say most, but many novelists are very concerned / apprehensive or downright bitter about film adaptations of their work. From at least the press I have read, you seem to be pleased.
John Crowley directed it, and he just directed it in a very sensitive, careful way from an adaptation by Nick Hornby. And Nick Hornby is a novelist. And I think the problem often becomes that somebody then starts to interfere between the writer, the screenwriter, and the director, saying, for example, there's an Italian family. And it was an Italian said to me recently, you know, the minute you see an Italian family in a film from these years, you think mafia. And your film doesn't do that. And it was such a relief to Italian people of Italian origin in America to have just one family for once. It's like having, you know, if you're Irish, not having one drunken fight. There's no drunken fight in the film. So all those cliches are missing from the film. Now, it just would take one money person, one guy in a suit, to say we need a mafia moment to mess up the whole thing. And we were so lucky that person was absent from the equation. So that really what they were trying to do, both Nick and John Crowley, I think, was get the vision of the book as accurately as possible down and then light it and then actually make a film from it. And we were lucky with Saoirse Ronan because she's a lead actress at exactly the right age. If we'd got the money when we wanted to get the money about 4 years or 3 or 4 years earlier, she would have been 17, too young to be in the film.
Right.
So we were lucky we didn't get the money, although it didn't feel like that at the time, that when we wanted the money, we got it a few years later. And then Saoirse was at exactly the right age. She hadn't done an Irish film before. This was her first Irish part. She'd done everything. The Grand Hotel Budapest, The Lovely Bones, Atonement. She'd been English, American, European. She'd been everything. Suddenly she could come home as an actress. You know, we were very lucky to find someone of that caliber at exactly the right moment. Really, it wasn't merely a painless experience. We were lucky and I was lucky.
Have you seen her in The Crucible?
I have. And she's able to do some. There are moments in The Crucible where Saoirse Ronan is at the back of the stage and you know what's going on in her mind.
Yes.
It's going around and around in her head what she has done. And will she now tell the truth or will she hold on to this myth or this intense evil she's created? What will she do? And in her face, even though it's, you know, it's not, the camera's not right up in her face, you can't take your eyes off her. She looks amazing in it. And you see, it's almost essential that drama is there, that she could at any moment say, look, I made it up. Look, I have to tell you the truth. And that she's stopping herself and that she's tempting herself and that it's going around in her head. That's another drama that keeps The Crucible moving dramatically. But she has no lines for that. It has to come in her face. That's what John Crowley, the director of the movie of Brooklyn, said about Saoirse, that she would have made a great silent era actress, that her face can do so much work.
Callum Tobin is our guest, and we are talking to him about his work. You just mentioned in film the avoidance of those Irish cliches. Are you aware of that in writing novels as well? Because in all stereotypes, there is a grain of truth. So do you look at those sometimes when you're writing and say, I don't want to veer into that territory?
I think you have to do that all the time. For example, in one of the short stories, I have an Irish widow in her 80s. The first thing you got to do with her is have downtown every week to get her hair done. She's driving her car, and she's not driving her car badly. She's driving it well. And she knows how to use a DVD. She knows how to record programs. She's in charge of her life. Constantly you have to watch, just in case, you know, you have an Irish widow in, for example, in Nora Webster. Just be careful not to have her being sad all the time. That there are things that make her laugh. There are things that make her angry. She's got many characteristics. Music really fascinates her. She makes friends. Yes, she thinks about her husband. Yes, she's lost her anchor. But in this new life she's creating, many different things are happening to her. And she's a mother. But sometimes she forgets about her children. I mean, she's not permanently sewing and darning or making soup for her sons and watching their every move. Sometimes she sort of forgets about them and hopes they're okay. So you're constantly playing with ideas of what will the reader expect? I need to make sure that I don't go into central cliche for each character. And therefore, you've got to create, got to give a character more than one characteristic. And therefore, you've got to give also a character ways of being that are slightly unexpected, that don't just fit into some easy cupboard. So that every sentence you've got to say, no, no. She went for a run. Afterwards, she was tired. No, she went for a run. Afterwards, she felt great. She could have run. No. And you keep working out. After the run, she went up and had a shower. Oh, after the run, she decided not to have a shower until later. And she just sat on a chair and read. You know, so you're constantly working out. What will the reader expect? What's the easy thing? And try and work out some other way. But don't do that all the time either. Sometimes let her go straight from the run to the shower. You know, and then, oh, her hair, worry, how will she dry her? You know, so you're constantly working on detail. And the detail sometimes has to be what the reader expects, and sometimes then something that the reader did not imagine.
Certainly that was the case. And admittedly, I saw the Broadway show before I read the novel, and that is The Testament of Mary. We have ideas of the church and, of course, the Irish relationship to it. How much was that in your mind when you took on this idea to write the story of Mary?
I was aware that I was breaking glass. Mary was known as the meek mother or as the grief-stricken mother, but that she did not speak. Her voice, that in the Testaments, she speaks a little bit, only really as a mother of a boy. We don't actually hear her. So once I imagined the idea that with nothing to lose as an old woman, she might describe what she saw, I realized that this was something that hadn't been done before, you know, and that might offend people, and that I had to be careful in not to censor myself. But also, I wasn't getting involved in mockery. I wasn't getting involved in open blasphemy. I'm not angry with the church. I don't have those feelings. I was thinking about the character and the voice. I didn't know sometimes when I got up in the morning what she was going to say today. I had to control her voice. I had to, you know, it wasn't as though she began to control the book herself, but I did all the same know this is important that I get this right, that this might matter to people in a way that another novel might seem as a form of entertainment, just to while away an afternoon. The Testament of Mary is not like that.
When it came out, pretty much everyone said the same thing, that this was a departure for you. Did you see it as such?
I suppose I was writing in a very calm tone. You know, I was still writing Nora Webster. I had written Brooklyn. The sentences, as you know, are very plain. There are no great flourishes. And they're written in third person. It's the interior of somebody who's not going to be Queen of Heaven, who is, in a way, an ordinary person in a town and emigrating. Obviously, with this, I'm moving into the tone is heightened, first-person voice, more staccato. I'm using a different sort of sound, and I'm aware that I'm dealing with much, say, in ostensibly larger questions, although I would argue that the questions for these minor characters in a small town are also large. But these questions, the questions that Mary is dealing with about faith and doubt, about redemption, and really about religion and, you know, about what we believe, about 2,000 years of tradition, it was entirely different.
And yet, in reading Nora Webster, there are certainly commonalities in what that character of Mary and what many of the characters in this novel are going through.
Yes, I suppose no matter what I do, I mean, I really should get a psychiatrist, that, you know, loss comes up and won't go away. It may be something as simple as that I lost my father when I was 12, and that no matter what story or novel I write or play, here it comes again, here it comes again, here it comes again. When I don't mean it to come again, I suddenly find I've written another few pages with some image of loss there. I would combat it if I knew how, because I would like to go on and write comedies, but I've never been able to.
What do you think holds you back from writing comedy?
I wouldn't be any good at it. You know, in other words, that the reader would just stop laughing at page 3. And what would hold me back writing comedies was no one would publish them and no one would read them.
But with that said, there's great humor in the novels.
Well, yeah, there are moments of dry humor and there are moments. Yes, there are certainly moments. I mean, there's a moment in Nora Webster where she gets drunk. I mean, this woman who keep feeding her different sorts of drinks, baby sham, brandies and things, in this bar after a quiz, and herself and this friend of hers start singing, and of course they go out of tune and it's really humiliating. And then they drive across the countryside singing bits of songs. I needed something at that point in the book that was lighter, that was just different to the daily grind of trying to find a new job or dealing with her children, just something new. And I suppose humor helps with that.
You have been describing writing many of these works while also Nora Webster was percolating. So now that that has been out, has it allowed you a bit of a clean slate, or were there other things that had been in the works?
I really wanted to finish it. I mean, the last year or two working on it, I was working in longhand. So then just typing it up and realizing this now, I will not be able to tell the story again. It was a sort of a loss in a way. This story is now told. I started it in 2000. The book came out, I think, in 2015. It's over. That story of what happened to us at home has now been told. And the thing was, you see, by the time I was really working on it, my brother had died and my mother had died. So I was the only one of the three who remembered what happened. So it was just me. It wasn't as though I could hand the book to the others and say, here's a story of us. No, I couldn't do that. I was alone with those experiences, which I think happens to people as they get older. Certain things that happen to you, you're the only one now who remembers, especially when your parents pass on. So I was sad about it, and I sort of missed it.
I know in losing my parents that the people that you go to ask the questions about what happened are gone. So did that hinder the novel at all?
No, I remembered everything. You see, I suppose I noticed her. There were just the three of us in the house, and she went back and found work, and she would come home from work and talk all about it, and we'd listen to her. She'd always have loads to say when she, you know, I have this thing about, you know, if you go downtown in any town, when you come home in our house, you always had to say, well, who did you meet? You know, what did they say? And you could tell the story as though something amazing had occurred downtown, even though you just met one person who had told you something minor. But you could never come home and just say nothing happened. And so I remembered everything. I invented some of the book. My mother didn't have a singing voice. I just needed to give Nora one more thing. But the music, the going to the Gramophone Society, it's so innocent now, isn't it? In the 1960s, they would bring a stereo record player once a week into the hotel of this town, 6,000 people, and about 12 or 15 people would sit around, and it would be one person's choice each week. And my mother would come home and tell us all about who did what. And they've all passed on. There was one woman who would actually, if there was orchestral music, she would pretend she was a conductor and she would conduct to the irritation of all the others. And there was one priest who was a very nice man, and he just talked about sopranos as though he knew them and was living with them. And we talked about Rita and Rita Strike, Joan Sutherland, and, you know, Marilyn Horne. And he was talked about them as though they were his lovers. And my mother and her friend thought this was amazing, the way he would do this. He just loved sopranos, and he listened to them when he was free to do that. And so she would come home and tell us these stories, and I remember them.
This, from the reviews of this novel of Nora Webster, many, if not most, critics said that it was your greatest work. I ask this question in two parts. One is, do you consider it to be something that you're proud of? And the second part of the question being, if yes, is it because it's so personal?
I think it's also a way of saying that in a novel now, you can still write the story of one individual's spirit without any irony or any mockery or any postmodern tricks, that you can just write the story down and it might matter to the reader. That is still possible despite everything that has happened. And I suppose I'm proud of that idea, that I went back to a form that maybe Jane Austen had perfected and that George Eliot had worked with and Henry James had worked with. Essentially a 19th century form of having a single character, a single spirit, whose life is being dramatized in a book. And also the idea is, say, in the French novel in Balzac and Flaubert, of Madame Bovary, of someone, say, living in a small town, a provincial place, having their life dramatized as though it's important. Someone like Alice Munro had been doing it in Canada for a long time in short stories. but I was aware of it as something that I thought I could still do. And if you could still do, then you could hit readers emotionally in a very serious place for them. So to that extent, I was proud of the book.
Colm Tabin's novels include Nora Webster, Brooklyn, The Blackwater Lightship, The Testament of Mary, and The Master. It is a great pleasure to have you on our program, sir. Thank you so much
Thank you very much.
Being with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.